Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 117 for September 1st, 2011. Hey, you're not Clay. Watch Autoline After Hours live at AutolineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline After Hours in the iTunes Store. Thanks for joining us again, folks, with me and the auto extremist, Peter DeLorenzo.
John, good evening.
Good evening. And we've got a bit of a reunion. David Welch is joining us for the show, too. Good having you here.
Great to be here.
Good to be here, but, you know...
You can only be here if you do the whole show in the Scottish accent.
Oh, that's a tall order.
Okay.
It takes a lot of time to keep that up. I don't know if the viewers can understand a thing I'm saying.
They'll figure it out in the podcast.
I was just hoping you'd bring your bagpipes. I wanted you to pipe.
Can have subtitles. You know, if he had sent me that email like 15 minutes earlier, I could have brought the pipes.
Yeah, because you got the notice to come on the show before you.
Well, I got the notice before that, but he asked the pipes this morning. I was already in the car halfway to the office.
And that's September 1st in Southeast Michigan, and my thermostat in my car registered 96 degrees on the way over here.
It was hot.
It is hot.
It's good. It's all good. It ain't February. I'm good with it.
Right. But yeah, I wanted those bagpipes. I thought that would have been cool to open
They're
the show.
Wild, and, though, but,
yeah, so.
See, I've got something cool on the way, though. I've ordered a set of Scottish small pipes, which play at about 60 decibels, which Highland pipes play at 120 to 130. And the decibel scale is not linear, so it's less than half the noise.
Uh-huh.
And you pump them with a bellows instead of breathing. So I could play those, and it's a little softer. Otherwise, you'll be breaking camera lenses and this kind of thing.
Play In a God of the Vita, man.
I can play Run Runaway by Slade.
Well, this we got. Okay, you're coming back on this show because that we got to hear.
I'll play Run Runaway by Slade. That's a good tune to play, too.
So you're busy these days. You're doing okay, though. It's good to have you back on the show.
Yeah. You're at Bloomberg.
Writing for Bloomberg, still writing for the magazine, so I do both.
Completing your work on your MBA.
Be done in March, early March.
That's a fast MBA.
You know, it is. Well, it seems that way, but it's a 22-month program.
It's not that fast.
And then what are you going to do? You can go into the business school and ruin another company like all the other MBAs,
exactly.
According to Bob Lutz.
You know, I've argued with Bob about this. My contention is you look at the MBAs that Bob's talking about. These are finance guys. A lot of them were... They had finance degrees, and GM sent them to usually Harvard Business School or one of the Ivies, and then started them off as analysts in the New York Treasury office. And this is 80s and 90s, and probably back in the 70s, too, but I know definitely 80s and 90s. And this is the era when all they cared about was the deal. Oh, it's EDS. Oh, it's Hughes. And we're going to IPO it and make billions, and cars is like this little side business that we have. And it was about cost-cutting and everything else, and they believed that they had so much market share and dealer exposure that they could put out mediocre products and still do pretty well. And that's pretty much how the company was run. And it was a finance-driven company. But if you take someone with any kind of degree and you put them through that system, which is a finance-driven system, and they grow up through the New York Treasury office and they never have anything to do with product, that's what you're going to get.
That's what you're going to get.
I know a lot of MBAs at GM who are really good car guys.
Mm-hmm.
Engineers.
If you go back to Sloan, who everybody at GM has always revered, he was scared to death of financially driven decisions. That was, you know, probably one of the things that kept him on the board as long as he could, because he was afraid as soon as he was gone, they were just going to start making all their decisions based on finance.
And he was right, because the first real finance born CEO was Frederick Donner.
Fred Donner would call my house.
You were telling me. We talked about Donner.
Yeah.
Donner was
my dad was there. Oh, he was a
He groomed Roger Smith to take over. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Donner launched GM Assembly Division, GMAD, I call it, which is what really blew up the engineering expertise, sent it hither and yon. And that was the beginning of the end of quality there, because nobody knew how to do anything. They centralized all the manufacturing, and that's when you had like Chevy engines and Buicks and Oldsmobiles, and the customers were pissed because, you know, I'm not paying extra money for an Olds and I'm getting a Chevy engine, even though it was probably mechanical.
But you know what drove that, actually? What led to forming GMAD, GM Assembly Division, was...
The antitrust.
It was antitrust. There was a senator from Michigan, no less, Phil Hart, who was leading the charge to break Chevrolet off General Motors, because GM had about 50% market share. So they said, this is a monopoly. It should be broken up. And so GM said, well, let's fix it so we can't be broken up. So they started GMAD, which would start assembling multiple different brands under the same roof. So GM could say, hey, you can't break us up because Chevrolet is no longer a standalone company within General Motors.
You know, this brings me something a little more recent here. I just did a story on Ackerson in the magazine. And I got
Good article. I read it.
Yeah, it was good.
I got a long-awaited interview with him, and
didn't you have to wait almost a year?
Pretty much.
That's only because you pissed him off the last time.
Yeah, I did.
True.
This is, and I'm not saying this is what they're doing now, but what he wants to do is, you know, GM has these seven global engineering centers, you know, in
which
Europe,
is only six too many.
One could argue, but here's where I'm going with this, and I don't know the answer. It just always makes me nervous whenever GM starts yet another reorganization of engineering and product development, because they've been doing it over and over again. You know, so you got Russelsheim in Germany. They do compact car engineering, and the U.S. does trucks, and Korea does subcompacts, and so on, and that's where the expertise is, and then they take that platform, and they build cars off it and sell them the world over. And really, GM hasn't had a vehicle in quite a while that was bad or that flopped in the launch. Pretty much everything they've put out has at least done pretty well.
Since when?
Going back, I would say since the current Malibu.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. So since
like
Lutz got
years.
There is what you're saying, essentially.
Well, yeah, and Lutz set up a lot of this thing. And Kelger set up flexible manufacturing to do it. Now, I'm not trying to, you know, do this big apology for the old GM management team, because the company went bankrupt when they were there, but it seems to be working pretty well, and he wants to get rid of some of those centers and consolidate some of that. I'm sure there's a way to do it. Ackerson is right that their competitors, Toyota, Hyundai, et cetera, do not have seven engineering centers. Maybe you're right. Maybe it is six more. But I get nervous whenever they start.
No, you're right. They don't need another reorganization. They should just leave the company as it is for another 20 years and just really concentrate on doing things exceptionally well. Who cares if your engineering costs are slightly above what the competition is?
They say they're way above. I haven't seen the numbers.
Well, they know the numbers. I certainly don't. But, I mean, come on. To your point, they don't need another reorganization right now. Just when everybody's learning, you know, if I got to do something in Germany, I call Helmut. If I got to call Australia, you know, I call Ian, and, you know, so on and so forth. There's this ad hoc relationship within General Motors, you know, that lines or organizational charts don't really capture. And when you start doing reorganizational changes, I mean, that's what really tears up a company. In fact, if you look at GM's market share going back 30 years now, things were chugging along pretty good until 1984, when they did the big reorganization there under Roger Smith. And if you look at any market share charts, 1984, at the end of that year, boom, it just goes into a nosedive and only recovers in the last year or two.
Well, and that's when they got into the whole deal thing and Saturn, and it was every cure for GM back then was something other than fixing the products that they were making and putting out better stuff.
But they're doing pretty good right now, as you point out. And in fact, you know, we just got car sales for the American market for August today. And GM didn't do half bad. In fact, the whole market didn't do that bad.
Yeah, and Chrysler did fabulous for the second
Chrysler
month in a row.
Had a fantastic month.
Some of Chrysler's new stuff, there isn't a lot of it, but it's pretty damn good. I mean, the Grand Cherokee is good.
Don't forget that stuff was there before Sergio got there.
That's right. This is not Sergio's stuff. Well, with two except the Chrysler 200 and the 300. The 300 was already underway.
And the 300 isn't doing very well, is it?
The 300's doing what I would say mediocre. It's doing about 20. Charger's doing okay, too.
Durango is doing pretty well. And it's a pretty good-looking vehicle.
Guess what's doing well in America right now? Trucks.
And big SUVs.
And big SUVs and crossovers, of course. I mean, people buy what they want. You know, you can make all the legislation you want.
It's not just that, but remember, and I don't remember, I only remember my opinion because I'm going to
sit here. It's the only one that counts if you're in your own opinion, right?
I'm going to sit here and say I was right. But remember when the Gulf spill was going on and we were having a conversation, I forget who the guest was, and we were saying, there was an argument, oh, this is the end of big cars and this will change everything. And I said, nope, Americans don't care. You know, there'll be this brief scare, they'll change their buying habits for a month and then go back to the same old thing. And we have.
Well, I had a Cadillac Escalade Platinum Hybrid for a couple of days, and I called it an engineer.
Did it have spinners?
It had 22-inch chrome, great-looking wheels, and I wrote on the site, it's an engineering marvel. What the American car companies have done with these large vehicles, the engineering job they've done to make them drive the way they do. And I mean, it's not I'm not talking about the hybrid per se. I'm talking about dynamically, you get in, you drive these vehicles, they're seamless, they don't act like they weigh, what does that thing weigh? Almost 6,000 pounds or 5,800 pounds, and you would never know it. I mean, it's just amazing. And that helps people buy those things because they just, there's no penalty to draw except when you have to drive by a gas pump.
Well, I was really impressed with car sales because everyone's saying, oh, woe is us, the economy's going down the tubes and up year over year, which is not a surprise, but up over July, which kind of surprised me. Now, July, you've got, 4th of July holiday and all that, blah, 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 but still, sales came in stronger than I thought they were going to be based on what everybody was saying.
Well, I'll give props to the Auburn Hills boys and girls. I'm not convinced the Fiat 500 is going to successfully relaunch Fiat in this country. I still think once the first on the block people get them and then they have to really start selling them, they're going to have trouble.
I've driven it, and it's pretty nice, but
it's pretty nice.
I'm a mini driver, and that thing's way too small for me. The back, it's not even a 2+2 is generous. I don't even know if you could sit a kid back there unless you really push the passenger seat forward. There's just no...
cramped, and it's especially the headroom. I think you can fit in there, but you're hunched over in it.
It's a two-seat fashion statement of the moment in 2011. Mm-hmm. It's after that that I'm talking about, and everyone says, oh, no, you're wrong. It's going to be every bit as successful as the Mini. I'm not buying it.
I'm not buying it, but they did sell another 3,000 last month.
Well, they will continue to sell them.
Bad numbers for that car.
No,
I guess it'll settle in around 20 to 25,000 a year.
I think that's generous. I think 16,000 to 20,000, after year two is where I see it going.
People live in New York or San Francisco or something like that and, don't have big families. I think it could work. Places like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is more usable than a Smart, and it doesn't have that sort of ridiculous golf cart.
My bicycle's almost more usable than a Smart, but that's okay. Should we do the first commercial break now so we can really get into the...
Yeah. We do have to thank one of our great sponsors here. And, folks, if you see their ad on our website, click it on, show your support for this show by doing that. And, Ben, why don't we thank Bridgestone for their support of us? Bridgestone is featuring its third generation of run-flat tires with groundbreaking new technology. Current run-flat tires can offer peace of mind for consumers But the added mass and the stiffer sidewalls can compromise ride comfort and fuel efficiency. The new third-generation Bridgestone Run Flat tires reduce heat and improve performance and ride comfort. Whether you're a program manager in the industry or just looking for a set for your personal car, check it out at BridgestoneTire.com. Peter, you and I had a pretty good thing going this week. We got to see the Cadillac CL up close and live.
It showed up on the cover of the Free Press business page.
That's right.
And we ran into Mr. Welch there, too.
That's right.
Oh, yeah, you were there. That's right.
And the significance of the CL, you know, it's amazing to me. A lot of people still don't get the whole concept car thing. You know, they just don't understand.
They say, are you going to make this, you know, you're going to see it 18 months.
Yeah. The CL is telegraphing something. Now that we've seen the renaissance of GM design, which really is a great thing for the business, they don't do concepts unless there's a reason to do it. What is GM working on for sure, even though they dance around this? I heard them dance around it. They're working on a super luxury sedan for Cadillac. 100 grand range, you know, right around 100. And that CL telegraphs the look and feel of that car, especially the front, especially the side sculpturing. You know, are they going to introduce it as that roadster? No. But the sedan version of it, and Clay Dean, didn't he acknowledge, oh, yeah, we have a hard version with a roof on it.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, what do you need other than to know that about 2014 or so, it's going to come out probably as a 2015, the super Cadillac.
In fact, we should mention, Clay Dean was supposed to be here tonight.
Yeah.
In fact, we had been promoting the fact, but he had a family emergency, was not able to be here tonight. But he will be here in a couple of weeks. And we can talk all about the CL again with him. But
it's a gorgeous car in person. I mean, the thing I like about the CL is it's unapologetically American and it's unapologetically Cadillac. It's only that car only Cadillac could do.
And it's unapologetically luxury, too.
Yeah, and it's big, and they're shipping it to Frankfurt.
It's not making this so responsible luxury.
Got some hybrid, whatever, drivetrain, whatever. They're shipping it to Frankfurt, and you watch the European press go gaga over that thing.
Well, what I love is, you know, I like the car as soon as I saw the pictures because it is so bold. It's really a styling statement.
And the surface detailing is
awesome.
Superb.
And that's one of the other things.
Like the headlights.
The headlights are so cool, those LEDs. But, you know, that's what's so cool about LEDs is it lets the designers do almost whatever they want with them.
Oh, and the wood in the interior is from an olive tree.
Yeah. I think they said it's a 300-year-old olive tree.
Yeah. But the listeners and viewers should pay attention to the front end in particular of that car.
The front end graphic.
Yes, because the next generation CTS has a lot of that in it. And they should also just stand back and look at the overall side sculpturing and presence of the car, squint and put a roof on it, a very sleek roof, and you have a real good idea what this super Cadillac sedan is going to look like.
The thing that impressed me is Clay Dean said they spent a year and a half getting the surface detail right. That's a lot of time to work on surface detail on what is ostensibly a concept. But when you hear that they spent that much time getting the surface detail right, you know this is not just a concept. It's to what you're saying, Peter. This absolutely signals where Cadillac is headed design-wise.
Yeah, and it's a runner because they had videos.
And yeah, we got it running on the screen here.
Yeah,
right
and
now.
It was driving. And it's just got great presence. And
what I like about it, too, as an owner of a Citroen DS, is they've made the cut lines part of the styling of the car. Most other car companies try to minimize the cut lines, make them as narrow a gap as possible to try and make it disappear. But in this case, the cut lines on the hood and the deck lid, the trunk, have got chrome strips, or it's not even chrome, it's bright work.
Steel.
Right. And it carries all the way down on the tops of the doors, too, and it really works. It just ties the whole thing together. And I love the fact that they're using the cut lines as a styling element in the car rather than just trying to gloss it over or hide it in some way.
Yeah, it's just, you'd spend some time walking around it and just looking at it. You really appreciate all the effort. They did a great job on it.
The interior, too, there's no ductwork, you know, for the heating or the air conditioning. All the ductwork is hidden in the car. There's barely any knobs or switches or anything like that. It's just such a clean look inside.
Yeah, you have to touch a panel to access if you really need to.
The car really reminded me, and they'll hate this over at Cadillac, but of the 63 Lincoln Continental.
You're not the only one to say that. A lot of people have said that. But I think part of it is it's a four-door convertible. Suicide doors in the rear.
But it's got that stance even. I mean, the Lincolns back then had much more subtle tail fins than the Cadillacs did.
Mm-hmm.
And this has subtle tail fins because it's a more modern Cadillac.
But I think, you know, that Lincoln going back then, too, was so slab-sided. And so if you're going to do a four-door convertible, big, and make it slab-sided, it's hard to avoid reminding you of that Continental.
But the CL, to their credit, has kind of old school fuselage look to it.
Mm-hmm.
Especially on the lower rockers.
Mm-hmm. The other thing too that's interesting is the grille is not modern at all. In fact, it looks like it could come right off the current DTS, the big sedan that they've got right now. And I asked Clay Dean about that, you know, why are you taking, like, today's grill, which really even harkens back over at least a decade now? And, it, you know, what he was saying is we wanted to take a totally new approach to the design, but we wanted to be able to have people instantly recognize that it's a Cadillac. So even though the grill doesn't look like they've done a whole lot with it, which is unfair because they actually have, but it's just so reminiscent of what's on the DTS right now. But, man, it works. With the rest of the car, it just pops, and you instantly recognize it as a Cadillac, but you just know this is something totally different.
Yeah.
And
is Clay Dean a star in GM's design team?
Well, yeah. He runs their advanced studio.
Yeah, no, he is.
So he's up there.
Yeah, he's a star.
I've interviewed him a couple of times over the years. The first, he did the original Hummer concept that had, like, all this cool brushed chrome and suede and everything in the interior that they eventually watered down with, like, GM T800 seats and plastic and ruined the vehicle. But his concept was cool. He led the team that did the current Malibu, which really brought GM back in the family sedan business.
Right.
Because I remember I thought it was a pretty cool design back then, and I did a feature on it for the magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And said, yeah, I want to talk to the lead designer. So it's Clay Dean. I'm like, oh, I talked to him before. Like, yeah, he was the Hummer guy.
And, well, it's no accident that Clay's visibility has been...
Right. But what he'll tell you is that I can't remember the guy's name. It's Nicky something. It's a Brit who actually came up with the original sketch for the CL. So, you know, and Clay Dean will be the first one to tell you that. He didn't do the car, but he ran, you know, the advanced studio. The car was done in California.
Yeah,
it wasn't even done here.
Just like, you know, when Bill Mitchell, the original Stingray.
Mm-hmm.
That was Larry Shinoda. And Peter Brock actually was working on, and a couple other guys. But it's just like in advertising, when you're the executive creative director, you get the interviews and stuff, but there are other people who, you know,
but then
work
too,
on it. But Clay, make no mistake, Clay's a big-time
and
talent.
And he's the guy who said, that's the sketch we're going to use.
Yeah, and that's the role. That's what you do. That's what Ed Welburn does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what you have to do. And you got to... And that takes a particular skill. And speaking of concepts, Ford just blew the lid off the automotive world this week with the stunning Evos concept, which no one saw coming, except we saw it was coming. But, you know, when they showed it, it's the reader response, the emails we got, it was just like people were just blown away by the Evos. They love the car.
I do, too. And again, talk about a lot of surface detail.
And people should pay attention. I mentioned this on the site. Take, you know, forget about the doors, like John, you said. Forget about the doors and a lot of the...
Because they're gullwing doors.
Yeah, the concept car stuff. Take a real good look at the front end.
That actually annoys me when companies put stuff like gullwing doors on concepts that we know we'll never see. I mean, I know it's fun, it's a design exercise, blah, blah, blah. You don't get a real good look at what the car is going to be like because it's got these unrealistic...
Well, they don't want to give it all away.
Yeah, but take a real good look at that front end signature.
And the rear end graphic,
yeah,
too.
on the Evos, and you're looking at, they're telegraphing the new look of Ford that's coming, and they're not kidding.
And, you know, this one's a fastback, too. So I'm, you know, I'm saying it's the fastback and the gullwing doors that are just auto show eye candy. But
they could do the fastback.
I don't think that it's going to be a fastback, is what I'm saying. Not like on this car. That's what I'm saying.
But it's a gorgeous car.
But I think...
And they're going to show that at Frankfurt, too.
Right.
They're going to want a fastback, though, because the Cross Tour's done really well.
Now, the DLO, you know, the side window graphic, I do believe is what we're going to see in the production car, or something very similar to it. But I just don't think that you're going to be able to get the headroom that a family sedan, which is what the Fusion is, because I think we're looking at the next generation Fusion and Mondeo in Europe. That's why I'm saying I don't believe it's going to be a fastback.
Yeah, that's what I said on the...
They could have a sport version of it, though, that has something...
They could, yeah. No, I would agree with that. But, you know, that roof line is so fast at the back, I can't believe there's any good headroom back there.
That's why I said on the site, pay attention, kids, there will be a test this car. You will see this. A lot of the overtones, design overtones in this car are going to end up in production.
And to me, there's almost a Jaguar-esque look to the nose.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Or Aston Martin. I mean, you know, that's a pretty significant, the new look and feel of Ford and design, that's very significant.
Now, the design's been getting better for a while.
Yeah.
Well, you know, think about it, too, because getting rid of brands like Aston and Jaguar and Volvo and Land Rover, for that matter, too, really frees Ford up. You know, you can't say, oh, we can't do that because that looks a little bit too much like a Jag. No, you can do whatever you want right now.
Yeah, especially I would think more so with Lincoln, because when they had all those European luxury brands, Lincoln was the poor American cousin, and they treated it that way.
No, not anymore. I mean, we're going to be seeing some pretty exciting stuff coming.
Yeah, and we've talked about the new MKZ.
And by the way, Jag and Aston Martin, I mean, their designs were so similar, they sort of bled into each other. I mean, Aston Martin was basically Jaguar XO.
Right, right. But I think you'll see some Volvo-ish elements, especially in the rear three-quarter and rear end of the Lincoln MKZ. And again, I think by brooming out those brands, they can steal elements now.
And also the interiors, Ford interiors, are going to take a dramatic step forward.
Well, that's saying a lot, because I think the current Focus is a pretty good interior for it.
But the new MKZ interior that's coming is pretty spectacular.
You know, when you look at the front-end graphic of this Evos, they've been using this trapezoidal grille, but on the lower fascia. Now they've moved that up as the main grill, which I like, too, because I never liked that. I still don't like it. Even on the Fusion and the Fiesta, that lower trapezoidal grill doesn't... It's okay. There's nothing wrong with it. But I think the way they've moved it up to be the main grill really gives it a much classier...
I think Ford, everything they make needs to be re-grilled. The Lincoln grill is just obnoxious, and it's a caricature. And the Ford grill just looks like a baseboard heater or something.
The three bars, you mean?
Yeah, it's terrible.
Well, they're going away from that. And the Lincoln grill, you'll see. You know, we had Jack Telnack here a couple of three, four shows ago, and his advice was keep working with it, because he thinks that what they call the bow wave is something that's unique to Lincoln, and he thinks they can keep on working that grill. And I would agree with him. And when you see the MKS, you'll see how they're starting to evolve it. But the MKZ, you go, oh, wow, now I'm starting to get it. Now I'm starting to see something that's truly Lincoln, that's, you know, not trying to harken back to that 63-ish, egg crate grill or, you know, I think if you look at the current MKS, the grill is—it's cool, but I don't know—it's just not luxury enough.
Yeah, but if you look back to luxury cars like Packards and stuff, they used to switch grills all the time. What is this thing where you have to have some grill and stick with it for like 30 years and put it on every model you've got? Why? Just make a good-looking car.
No, you're right. And, I mean, if you look at the twin kidney grill, as it's called, for BMW, it's still there. But, man, it's evolved completely over the years. And whether you're talking about Packard or even Duesenberg, there was an element to it that you could instantly recognize. Oh, that's a Packard, that's a Duesenberg, or even a Pontiac or a BMW. But it changes. It definitely
Pontiac
evolves.
Never changed. They hadn't changed it about 20 years before the brand was killed. And I think that was a real mistake because maybe 30 years. I mean, you go back through the 80s and they had very similar looking grills.
Yeah, but it's a tragedy that Pontiac went away. It really is.
It really is. Hey, it's time that we should bring up one of our other sponsors here and thank them for supporting this show, because we truly do appreciate their support. And Ben, why don't we thank our friends at Hyundai? The sixth generation of the Hyundai Sonata is taking the industry by storm, and no wonder. It offers a fluidic design theme that gives it a strikingly modern, coupe-like exterior design, and yet the interior provides the roominess of a full-size car as measured by the EPA. The Sonata also provides an eco-friendly interior with soy-based foam for the seats. Put it all together with Hyundai's strong reliability and value proposition, and you've got yourself a really compelling package. Check it all out at HyundaiSonata.com. You know, it's interesting, all these concept cars that we've been talking about are at least two of them, the CL and the Evos. But I'm wondering, is that a smart thing for a company to do? Should you be signaling where your styling is going this far in advance?
Well, that's been a pet peeve of mine. I think they've gone to extremes now. Ford's introducing some models about a year from now, a little less. And, you know, to me, that they just can't help themselves. About a year out is as far as they're willing to risk it. If, you know, left to their own devices, they're showing stuff 18 months, 24 months. I don't like it. I want to go back to the first time you see a car at an auto show, they're taking orders then, and that's the first time you see it. Yeah, is that going to happen in this age of the 24/7 media and digital cameras? No. But I would love to go back to that. I want something to be unveiled that no one saw coming. And, oh, yeah, by the way, we're producing it in 2 months, and we can take your order now.
Problem is, someone's got to be willing to kind of take it on the chin for a while and do that, because everyone else is showing all this great stuff, and you're under wraps. You're not saying anything. Everyone says, no one knows what's going on over there. There's no product plan. There's no buzz. I mean, you got to put up with that for a while.
And they're not willing to do it. They get nervous because you're only as good as your last, you know, media event. And what was the one good example is when they showed the CTS Coupe, which no one knew was coming. They showed it at the Detroit show. They got it into production, 3 years later? And that was the quickest they can do it. Maybe it was 2.5.
It was probably 3.
Yeah. And then the Camaro was 3 years. But they made the mistake of showing that Camaro day in, day out. And they just couldn't help it. And then by the time it came out, now they're selling. But, you know, my attitude on that is if you're showing it 3 years out and it's not coming out, then something's wrong. You need to exercise restraint and don't show it more than a year in advance.
Not anymore, they shouldn't. You know, I can understand where, you know, the Camaro's been out of the market and they're trying to get people to not buy Mustangs or maybe Dodge Challengers. And so, you whet their appetite. I guess I understand that sort of thing. I understand if you go back 3 or 4 years ago where, you know, the Detroit companies had just put out so much crap, they had to show the public, to your point, David, that they had good stuff coming. They don't need to do that now. And so, look, I love being able to see the Evos right now. I love this conversation we're having about it and dissecting what's going on at Ford Styling. But for what? I mean, the Fusion and Mondeo are going to be, they're right around the corner. So even if you're using this arguably as a testbed to see how does the public react to this styling, It's too late, Jack. I mean, the tooling for the car is already done. Even if the public throws up when they see it, it's too late to do anything about it. So I don't understand.
Yeah, I want one manufacturer. If you're locked in, then just don't show it.
Don't show it. And it's like the CL. I love the CL. I love being able to see it this far in advance and talk about it. And we'll get Clay Dean on here and have him talk about it even more.
It's 4 years away.
Right. Why do it? It's crazy. Why let your competition know so far in advance where you're going? To me, it's nuts.
Yeah, because if I'm sitting there over at Ford, I'm saying, we need to take a real good look at that next generation MKS. We're going to go back and we're going to blow the doors off this. We're really going to go for it. That's what I'm doing.
Have something coming in the interim then. But then, you know, we've already seen the XTS. So I don't know what they would have that would wear some of those CL styling cues.
And it's too bad because I think actually the XTS is going to do very well.
I agree.
Because it looks good. The finished production version looks really good. And that's getting lost in the shuffle.
Right. Well, again, you know, we saw that, you know, was it about the time they were going through bankruptcy or right after?
Yeah.
So they had to show us, hey, don't write us off yet. We've got something coming.
Yeah, we got the ATS, we got the XTS.
Right, so I understand why they did that then. But they don't have to show us the CL right now. And to your point, Peter, why?
Because we're not going to see that car.
It's going to be, it doesn't matter, David. I think it conveys exactly where Cadillac's going. No, it's not going to be the Roadster. It will be a sedan. But that front-end graphic, I do believe, and a lot of the styling cues. Like I said, you don't spend a year and a half trying to get that detail, surface detail, the way you want it, just to say, well, we'll change it when we get into production. So, you know, if I'm Lincoln, I'm going, whoa, doggy. I don't have to hold back here. If that's where Cadillac's going, I'm going with, because they all do multiple designs, evaluate different designs.
Cadillac is basically, I mean, the Escalade is, among a certain cadre of people, pretty cool, but I don't think, in this luxury market, it's not really that relevant. The relevant vehicles they have.
Yet they're coming out with a new Escalade.
No, they are, but I mean, the heart of the line, what they really sell is, it's the SRX and the CTS. The CTS has been out for a few years now, and the SRX is already starting to level off in sales. And it's going to be a while before the ATS and the XTS are really in the line and selling. They've got to show people that, I think they have to show consumers, that there's going to be stuff on the road that is very cool and prestigious that will be on the road in the lifetime that they're going to be owning something that they would buy now and sort of create some aura around the brand, because I really think Cadillac had a bit of momentum, and it's getting stale. I mean, the sales numbers are still pretty good, but the vehicle lineup is so small compared to all the other luxury makes, it's just gone stale.
Well, but do you have to show the competition where you're going to be 4 years down the road? Isn't there something else that you can do to bridge the gap between now and the XTS and the ATS, which are next year, right?
I think pretty late, though.
Okay, well,
The XTS is coming sooner than the ATS.
I'm pretty sure that's right.
I thought the XTS was going to be in market next spring at dealers in, like, March.
Yeah, I don't know. I think you do something else. I think at this point where Cadillac is, it doesn't have to tip its hand as to where it's going.
Okay, so with Cadillac, we'll have something, some big sedan like the CL. You'll have the XTS, CTS, ATS. Should they do that subcompact mini fighter, the urban luxury concept that they showed in New York? And they may have showed it in L.A. But
L.A. too, yeah. You know, that's a good question. Look, as I keep saying now, if the Arab Spring turns into the Arab nightmare and oil prices spiral out of control, absolutely Cadillac should do that little car. And they should make it an electric, because that's what we're all going to be driving. But if that doesn't happen, I think if oil prices stay anywhere around $100 a barrel, we're not going to need little cars, and we're probably not going to buy a whole lot of electrics either. I think they're just going to have that hard a time competing until 3 or 4 battery generations down the road, where you can get a very good range and a very lightweight battery that doesn't cost that much. I just don't see this stuff catching on.
That's what's happening right now. Stuff's not really catching on.
No, but it's still first generation everything. So, you know, first generation battery, first generation power electronics, and for an electric car.
Yeah, but even hybrids aren't doing that great. And they
no, hybrids that much. Don't sell at all. I shouldn't say don't sell.
Did you pick up that much steam when gas got expensive earlier this year?
I know it. And that's what, and you know,
I love the stuff, but it's Americans by and large.
But it's not just Americans. I mean, hybrids haven't set the world on fire in any other market, with one exception in Japan when they had massive government subsidies. The Prius sold; it's still selling pretty well in Japan, but it's only the Prius. And in Europe and other markets where gasoline prices are very expensive, hybrids don't do that well. And electric's even worse.
Diesel's even lost some momentum in Europe, hasn't it?
It did for a while because there was a couple of things happening as emission standards tightened up in Europe and as the price of diesel started to catch up to gasoline and as gasoline engines go direct injection and dual clutch transmission and all this other stuff and they get a whole lot more fuel efficient. Diesel market share did go down a bit, but it's still hovering around 50% of the European market.
That's the thing with, there's still so much they can do with engines, and direct injection is proof of that, because it was 5 or 6 years ago that they were saying that the amount of money you have to put in the engine for, you know, noise deadening and NVH because of the higher compression of direct injection made it only applicable for like Audis and other expensive cars. Now they're all over the place, and they do really well in terms of fuel economy.
Hey, look, we've got to thank another one of our sponsors right now. And as I said before, we really do appreciate their sponsorship of this show.
Joel?
Right. So, Ben, let's thank our friends at Chevrolet for sponsoring this show. Not only does the Chevrolet Cruze offer a ton of features, it features some of the best safety and maintenance in the business. The Cruze comes with rear park assist, which beeps if you're about to back into something. It has rollover mitigation, which means the car senses if it might roll over, and applies the brakes to the outside front tire to bring the car back under control. And it has OnStar vehicle diagnostics, which sends you emails about the latest status of your car. And you can learn a lot more about it at Chevrolet.com/cruise. Okay, and this is the part of the show where we get to all your questions, and I hope I get them because I don't seem to have all that great an internet connection, though I do have some. Ben, let's bring up the graphic for rapid fire. Probably. Okay, Rumblestrip wants to know, David, are you going to learn some Dropkick Murphys with your bagpipes?
They have a very good piper who can play a hell of a lot faster than I can. I'd love to be able to play, and I have the CD. Why can't I remember the name of the tune? It's the soundtrack for The Departed. I'd love to be able to play that tune.
Yeah, well, that's a great
but tune. But that requires some fast fingers, and I may not have started the pipes early enough in life to ever be able to do that.
DC Auto Geek says, with Ford's recent announcement to partner with Zipcar and more quote-unquote studies that say millennials put a bigger emphasis on access versus owning, what impact will this borrowing versus buying have on the auto industry?
I think it's going to have an impact, but I think it's going to be limited in scope. I mean, I think it's going to be concentrated in places. I don't think it's going to replace the go out and get yourself a car thing. I really don't.
I don't either. I think Zipcar works well in college towns and other cities where it's real expensive to own a car, yeah. Very expensive to pay for parking.
Yeah.
Then Zipcar makes a lot of sense.
It's good for tourists.
And that sort of thing. But I keep saying, you know, when you get in your Zipcar and, you know, the person in front of you had their little kid throw up in the back seat, or somebody spilled their McDonald's stuff,
and like that.
Right? Yeah, and plus, yeah, you go through that phase, and then you know you start working, and you want to go get something. Now, you know, there is a problem that a lot of the new generation coming up aren't interested in cars like we were, and I, you know, I'm. I'm noticing that too much, and it's kind of depressing. Too many of these car events, the age demographic is too high. You don't see enough young people. And as we've talked about before, this business right now is focused on trying to reach young people. And that's part of the offshoot of that Zipcar thing.
Baja Busta says, Peter, is it true the next Escalade will not be built off the GMT, but on the Lambda? Have you seen that future design?
Yes, I have. I wasn't supposed to, but I did see it, and it looks great on the Lambda.
Lambda's a good platform.
Well, I mean, that GMC version, the Denali, the Acadia Denali, we had one, and that's just a superb vehicle. And I inadvertently saw the Escalade on the Lambda, and it looked great.
I think they can do a lot more stylistically
yes.
with the Lambda platform than with a truck platform.
Yeah.
It's just not as rigid in terms of hard points. And
yeah, I just...
I don't know. I think a platform or a frame gives you all the flexibility in the world.
But at any rate,
You just build whatever body and bolt it onto the frame.
Yeah, I saw one, and it looked great. So.
But they never do. It's always the same basic shape as the other SUV.
Well, that's because, you know, again, they're trying to commonize too much with their pickup trucks. You know, interior metal, and that helps dictate the, you know, and I shouldn't just say the pickups, but with the Suburban and all that sort of thing, they try to use too much black metal as carryover.
I mean, Cadillac's problem is if they do that, which I think they're going to do it, is the Acadia Denali is so good and is kind of a word-of-mouth vehicle that if they do an Escalade version, it's going to have to be something else. It's going to have to be a spectacular. So that'll be interesting to see.
J.D. Clough wants to know, have you any news with respect to a Sonata/Optima wagon for North America, or can you find out through your connections? Wagons don't sell in America.
Yeah.
I think
when you have Ford coming in with the, you know, these, they're not really wagons. But Ford's version of the, well, it's not their version of the Mazda 5, but it's that.
MPV thing,
yeah.
Right.
I was once driving through Royal Oak, and I saw this guy in a Suzuki Esteem wagon. And I was very tempted to stop and just say, excuse me, but why did you buy this car? And I really mean, why did you buy this car? I mean, you know, wagons particularly.
I like wagons. Well, a lot of enthusiasts like wagons.
But what's happening is
they like Charger wagons and CTS wagons. We're talking about stuff like a Hyundai Sonata.
Well, the Charger wagon never sold, but the Ford C-Max that's coming, that mm-hmm. is going to probably do very well, I think.
Yeah, but it's to me, that's more minivan crossover than real wagon.
Yeah, I don't know if real wagons really have a chance.
I don't think
here.
They do, not in this market. I mean, a 540 wagon used to be kind of cool.
Yeah, and people really seek out the Audi.
The all-road. I keep seeing those every now and then.
But the Avant, you know, the people want them, but it's never going to be a big market like it was in the 50s and 60s.
Okay, Goggles Pisano wants to know, will there ever be a production Cadillac 16?
No. The ship sailed.
No, but, you know, and John, you and I were talking about that. There's a lot of 16 in that CL, especially in the side. The overall side image is very much 16.
Al from Lake Orion says, glad to see David back on the show. Then goes on to ask, did GM give up on the midsize SUV? No, I don't think. Midsize SUV, well, that would be what? Depending on how you're describing it, that would be the Chevy Traverse?
No, that's...
Oh, that's a crossover.
Yeah. I guess he's talking about the Trailblazer?
Yeah, well, they gave up on that, but Ford doesn't make the Explorer the same way. It's not a body-on-frame SUV anymore.
That's right.
So...
And Tahoe and...
The Explorer's doing very well.
Yeah, it is.
You could say the Lambda. Well, the Lambda is pretty big.
Oh, yeah. No, he goes on. I didn't finish reading this. He said, why did GM dump the GMT 360s?
Oh. That vehicle, remember when it died around 04, 05, when gas started getting expensive.
And they were at the point where they had to make a decision, were they going to invest the money in that product program? And they said, no, we're going to go
Fuel economy was bad, and that really was... You go back when gas was cheap, interest rates were cheap, and we had a housing inflated economy. That was the ultimate middle class discretionary purchase, where people bought it because they could. Once their credit card bills got big and they started losing their jobs and getting hired with a job that paid less and interest rates were up and, you know, they had mortgage payments that they bought when they were making more money, discretionary middle class gluttonous SUV that got like 20 mpg or 18 mpg. Remember the truck-based Explorer went to hell in a handcart, right, too, in terms of sales. That whole segment died. Nobody makes those anymore, really.
Okay, Steve asks, how soon will Ford and GM put four-cylinder direct injection turbo motors in their full-size trucks with current output so close to the previous V8? Actually, the four-cylinder stuff I don't think is that close to the V8s.
No, it's one thing to put it in the Edge and the
Explorer,
but you're not going to see it in F-150.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't think we are. Let's see. Jay Cujo says, why did the big three do so poorly in the stock market with double-digit gains? I think what he's referring to is today, Ford and GM and Chrysler had double-digit sales gains, but yeah, their stock all took it down the chin while the whole market was down.
Yeah, and you know, these days, GM and Ford, there's just no interest in those stocks. You buy auto stocks when you think the car market and the economy is going to start to turn up. These car sales numbers were better than people expected, but
they're not good.
They're not good.
Great. I mean,
still talking a SAR of 12.1, mm-hmm. 12.1 million vehicles when a lot of people figured we'd be around 13 by now.
Right.
And it's nowhere near that. It's not horrible, but this is still historically terrible.
Although GM and Ford are still saying by year's end it's going to be 13 or 13 plus.
And a lot of people are starting to doubt that, and I think that's why their stocks were down.
Well, we're also...
And that's sort of what investors are saying is, yeah, you guys might be right, but we're not really sure. So if you end up being right and not having to cut production, we'll take a look at your stock. See you in December.
Yeah.
That's kind of what they're saying.
Hey, Ben, I see we got a phoner. Let's bring that one in.
Hey, John. This is Ray in Columbus, Ohio.
Hey, Ray.
I watch you every day at noon.
All right.
Fantastic. And on Thursday night. Well, anyway, you've driven both the Ford Focus and the Chevy Cruze. Which one is better? That's all I got to ask. Bye. Keep up the good work. Bye.
Thanks. Which is better, the Cruze or the Focus? It depends what you want in a car. I'd say if comfort and quietness is really your bailiwick, go with the Chevy Cruze. If you're somebody who really likes the feel of the road and likes to drive harder, I think the Focus is the better car to go with. It depends on your taste in cars.
Yeah, I would agree. That's a good way to go to talk about those two.
So, yeah, I mean, I get asked all the time, what's the best car out there? It's like, it depends.
That is when I want to slap somebody when someone says, what's the best car?
Okay, Miss Motormouth is asking, let's do a baby question. John, David, and Peter, if you and partner were expecting your first child, which car would you pick and why? Well, David, you're the one who should start out with that.
Well, I have a Clubman S.
Mini Clubman.
And my wife's got a CTS. So, you know, we're got plenty of room with all that.
I don't know. There are so many family vehicles out there. Again, it depends. All I'll say is this. When you have a baby, it's not just a little baby in a car seat. It's a stroller and a portable playpen and a diaper basket and extra bottles and blah, blah. That's why people get minivans. Minivans are something like the Ford C-Max or the Mazda MP5. That's... if you're going to have a family, it's hard to beat those kinds of vehicles.
Or a 540 wagon.
I'd get a 911 GT2 RS Turbo and tell the significant other to figure it out.
And Peter, no kids. He figured it out.
Glenn E. says, I just leased a 2011 Kia Soul to replace my daughter's totaled 2003 Focus. Was this a good move? Top safety pick, only $212 a month for 36 months with all taxes and fees and only $500 out of pocket. Thank you. Yeah.
For that requirement, yeah, that's fine.
I think the Kia Soul is a cool vehicle. It's doing really well for them, you know.
I'm getting a Nissan Juke to drive next week. I like the Juke, too. I can't wait to get to drive one for a week.
Let's see. Jay Cujo, question for David Welch. Did you finally get your Synergy green Camaro, or do you still have the Mini?
I sold the Mini and bought another Mini, except I got a Clubman S.
Yeah.
Same British Racing Grand. I didn't get the Camaro.
Someday, maybe?
At the time I was buying, gas was getting really expensive, and I just thought, nah, not the right car. Plus, you know, we already have one GM in the garage. I write about all the companies. I can't buy one of everybody's cars, but I want to be a little bit ecumenical, or as ecumenical as I can. So I picked up, and I'm a happy Mini owner, so I got another one.
Prehistoric says, what does the panel think of GM dodging the warranty claims, saying that's the old GM?
That's a bad idea.
I think it's a terrible thing they're doing.
Just in terms of the public optics for consumers.
I mean, you know, look, hug your customers. Don't tell them, that was the old company that went bankrupt. You're screwed, Charlie. No, I think it's bogus on two levels. Number one, hug your customer. Number two, don't run to the government with all these tax loss carry forwards, which came from the old GM, and use them, and then screw your customer and say, oh, that was the old GM. I think it's totally bogus.
I don't know the side of the case, but they're a customer. You want to keep them. Why wouldn't you take care of these people?
DC Auto Geek wants to know, any thoughts on Fisker choosing BMW to build their engines? Does this have anything to do with the BMW i-Line, which is their electric stuff?
By the way, going back to another question, didn't the old GM, which still exists as an entity, wasn't there a fund in old GM for warranty? I can't remember.
I don't know if it's for warranty. There is a fund for environmental cleanup.
For all that, but I thought there was some money set aside for the warranty claims.
Huh. Yeah, I don't know, but, you know.
And that may be why the new GM doesn't want to pay it. I'd have to look at that.
Yeah, and is it the old brands? I mean, are they stiffened people who have got Chevys, Cadillacs, Buicks, and GMCs? If they are, that's a bad move.
Well, you're going to lose those people forever.
VRM Chris wants to know, when's someone going to make the next generation Neon? Low-priced, limited options, connectivity, fun to drive. Well, I think you're going to see something like that from Chrysler in about another year or so.
Well, in the spring, they're going to release their Cruise Focus competitor. But he's talking about, a smaller one?
I'm not sure. You know, low price, limited options. There was, what did they call it? The Neon America or something like that. There was a super low priced version of the Neon. It's hard to make money on that sort of stuff. But going back to the Fisker question, what I thought was amusing is that Fisker ostensibly is going to be taking 100,000 engines a year from BMW. I don't believe that for a second, that will happen.
Are they going to become an engine reseller?
Right.
I don't think they're going to sell them any cars.
No, they're not even going to build that many.
Well, you know what's interesting is, remember years ago Ford was buying diesel engines from BMW and putting them in the Mark 7, I think it was. I think it was the Mark 7. And Ford thought this was the way to go, and they committed to buying, I can't remember what the number was, 20,000 engines a year, maybe it was 40, I can't remember what the number was. Well, they committed to doing that, and when it turned out the market didn't want that car, they still had to pay BMW for those engines. And I wonder what kind of arrangement Fisker's got.
I thought they were only going to make 90,000 of the Karma.
Well, this is for a car called the Nina.
Nina, rather, yeah. I thought they were only going to.
Well, maybe this is for the. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's not 100,000 a year. Maybe it's 100,000 for the life of the vehicle. But I don't buy that either. 4 or 5 years of Nina, I don't think they'll hit 100,000. But that's me. Brian says, "Hi guys, has Saab finally used up all its 9 lives?"
I don't know.
Well, let's just say when you're trying to borrow money to meet payroll, that's a very bad sign.
I'm just glad I'm not a Saab dealer right now.
Me too. I you know, as I've said before, I think it's over for Saab. And
they're throwing a few hundred a month in this country.
In this country, and it's not much better worldwide. And as we've talked about before, they don't need $50 million here, $120 million there. They need $1 billion right now. And $1 billion will get them through the next 12 months. And then they're going to need another $1 billion. So that's why I'm saying that. I just don't see him pulling out of that.
Yeah, and you know,
they needed a real company with major operations, engineering, cash to buy it up.
Yeah, and besides, a billion here, a billion there starts to add up to real money.
Right.
You know, there's a catch-22 with Saab, and Volvo has it in a way, just not as bad. And that is, to make the cars that are real Volvos and real Saabs, it's expensive. But the brand doesn't command the prices to really make it a real go.
Well, the thing that may save Volvo is, you know, being in China right now via Geely. And
Volvo has a real player that's running the show.
Right. They have a chance because they've gotten into the Chinese market and sales are zooming. It's too late for Saab is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not saying this gleefully, and I don't want to see them go out. I'd be even more pleased to be proved wrong. But I'll bet I'm not wrong.
Yeah, it's not looking good.
Boy, what a downer to end it up on. We should have a happy question for the end. Let's go back to the baby one. But, hey, we ought to wrap it up. It is the top of the hour. But, David, great having you here, man.
Great to be back.
It's been fantastic.
Good to see you.
So I know you're still busy, but whenever you get a free Thursday night, you can stop over any time.
I may have more free Thursdays in a bit. My schedule might be changing a bit.
No, we don't want that frequent.
Yeah.
I'm just going to crack.
Yeah.
Especially if I don't want
only to. Only if you bring your bagpipes. Or what would you call those little pipes?
They're just small pipes. But
small pipes.
I might bring the Highland pipes anyway. I think the studio can handle it. You got enough acoustic material on the...
Oh, yeah, but we'll have to put the dog outside because the dog is not going to like those noises. So.
Yeah, sometimes they don't mind it.
No, he won't like that. He might like the small pipes or
he's
not.
He's a Rhodesian Ridgeback, right?
He is.
They're supposed to be one of the best guard dogs that there is.
He's an awesome guard dog. It's and it doesn't matter where you go. If you go someplace and, like, settle down, he realizes, okay, this is home. This is what I protect.
Really?
Yeah.
They're protective.
Yeah.
So if someone approaches you in a menacing way, does he go ape?
He sounds real mean. Real mean.
He doesn't look it. He looks like a...
No, he's a good dog. You know, if anybody approaches friendly, he'll just wag his tail, you know. But if somebody came in a threatening way, he can sound like a mean dog.
Ike.
Yeah. Ikey, eat a man.
Well, anyway...
Ike, throw down.
Yeah. We ought to wrap it up here. But, hey, a couple of shout-outs. You know, we'd been asking some people to help us test our new website, which we're going to launch next Tuesday, by the way, a redesign of the website. We just wanted to make sure everything was operating behind corporate firewalls. And for those of you who helped us out, thanks much. It really, truly was a help. Don't forget, OpenLine is coming next Tuesday. And so you can listen to that at bit.ly/OpenLine. We're also going to be doing a live webcast from the Frankfurt Auto Show, September 13th, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, which is going to be about 4 o'clock in the afternoon in Germany. But we'll give you a little taste of what's going on at the Frankfurt Show. And don't forget, you can always friend us at facebook.com/OutOfLineDetroit. You can follow us at twitter.com/OutOfLine. You can follow all of Peter's stuff at autoextremist.com or at twitter.com/autoextremist or at facebook.com/autoextremist. You can see David's stuff at Bloomberg.
Bloomberg.com. Or
and Business Week. No. Business, yeah, Business Week. Also, hey, we're going to have Roundabout. There will be an episode of that tomorrow night as well. And don't forget, folks, that you can get this show and others on your smartphone or BlackBerry. And you can win $100, maybe, if you sign up now at Stitcher.com/Outoline. Register your phone and enter the promotion code Outoline. You can get the apps at the iTunes or Android store. In any case, thanks so much for watching. We'll be back here next week. Visit our website, OuterLineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Outerline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Outerline Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at OuterLineDetroit.tv.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.